I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. If you've experienced this millennial flu from down under, the so-called Sydney strain, you don't want to hear what's worse than the sweating chills, the throbbing headaches, the blank depression that comes with it. But the influenza of 1918 was worse in every dimension. There was no relief from the wheezing. You coughed up bloody bubbles, and then eventually you died of pneumonia with your lungs full of pink fluid. Maybe 20 million people died of influenza in 1918, many more than the ruinous World War I had just killed. Probably twice as many more people died in the aftermath of influenza effects all over the world. 19,000 people died just in New York City. Medical science knows vastly more about killer viruses today, enough to have tracked that 1918 virus to the frozen lungs of people who died of it. The humbling and vaguely panicky further knowledge today is that the epic virus of 1918 could come back, or another one of those mutating viruses could someday find the opportunistic moment to do much the same sort of damage all over again. Everybody's talking about the flu this week. An awful lot of people have it. Our guest Gina Colata of the New York Times actually knows something about it, about the 1918 pandemic and the DNA links to the scratch in your throat today. Where does it hurt, Connection listeners? And why didn't your flu shot knock this one out? The Flu Connection Phone with Gina Colata and her book about flu, the story of the great influenza pandemic of 1918 and the search for the virus that caused it. The connection to all that is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Gina Colata. We're big fans of all your work in the Times.
Well, thank you. I'm a big fan of your program, too. Thank you so much.
Does everybody tell you their flu symptoms this week?
Well, it's all I hear about. That's true, yeah. I mean, every time I turn around, somebody says that they got the flu shot and then they got the flu.
You're talking to one.
You know what? I got the flu shot. I never had one my whole life until this year. After writing that book, I said, I need a flu shot. And I was on a television show, and I said, I never get flu shots because I never get sick. The next day, I was so sick. And I said, if I hadn't had the flu shot, I would swear it was the flu, but I know now that it is some other respiratory illness.
It was saying it that gave you the flu.
I think I was being punished for saying I was healthy.
Let's talk about 1918. And just to lay down a marker here, my father's Parkinson's disease was blamed to that flu. He had an older brother who died of it in World War I. So it's not exactly brand new to me, although there was a great deal of sort of public denial about it. Where did it begin? Who got it and why?
It's a really good question where it began. There are some people who think it began before 1918, maybe even in China. What happened, though, was when it really hit, it was everywhere, and no one could figure out how it was spreading so fast and so far. It reached every corner of the earth. The remotest places seemed to be hit by this flu. And when you talk about a deadly flu, it's almost hard to imagine. I looked on the CDC's website to see what's a typical Centers for Disease Control's website to see how many Americans typically die in an influenza epidemic like the one we're having now, because people do die, usually the very weak, very old. And it's usually about 20,000, which sounds like a lot. But if a flu like that 1918 flu came by today, it would kill 1.5 million Americans. And it's more than the number that are killed in a single year by the 10 leading killers, heart disease, cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's, everything combined. And it would strike large numbers of people in the prime of life between the ages of 20 and 40. So some people couldn't believe it was influenza. They insisted on putting the words influenza in quotation marks. They said it was a plague. They said it was germ warfare. They couldn't believe it.
We'll come back to the question of, if it came back, the kinds of numbers, the kinds of responses that would be possible. But go back to, stick with 1918 for a moment. Who was getting it? It wasn't simply a matter of vulnerable people, particularly as the modern research sort of reclocks the
results. That's what's so really surprising. Well, first of all, huge numbers of people were ill. I mean, most people who got this flu did not die. It's just that almost everybody got it, and a significant proportion of them died, so you had this huge death rate. So everybody was getting sick, it seemed like. In fact, there were so many people that were getting sick that that public gatherings were banned. Churches and schools were closed. People had to wear masks in public, which actually was kind of useless because the virus could get through the masks.
You've got a wonderful picture in your book of a ball player, a professional, with a little dainty napkin mask in his mouth at the plate.
And again, in that picture, everybody in the stands, in the bleachers, are wearing their masks too, and so is everybody in the field. It was a law in a lot of places that you had to wear a mask. I have another picture of a trolley car driver who's holding up his hand like saying stop to some poor passenger that's trying to get on without a mask because he wasn't allowed on without the mask.
But Gina, who did get it in 1918?
Well, everybody. I mean, like everybody. I guess I'm trying. You know, it's hard.
Everybody got sick, but why did it kill some people?
Well, that's one of the mysteries, and there are a couple of hypotheses. One of them is that maybe the young people, the real mystery is why did it kill people between the ages of 20 and 40? When they talk about the curve of the death rates, the mortality curve, it's shaped like a W. It kills at the very beginning of life, and then there's this huge peak in the middle of life when you're a young person, young adult, and then again at the end of life. So the question is, why do you have that middle peak of the W? That's the real big mystery here. And one of the hypotheses is that maybe the younger people are so healthy, their immune systems are so robust that they overdo it in trying to fight the flu. They rush in so much ammunition, all these white blood cells flooding into the lungs, that the lungs get, you actually are drowning because of your immune system's over response in trying to kill this flu. Which also raises the question, though, why did this flu do it? Which is another question. And what about the Parkinson's disease connection? And that's another question. So there are a lot of mysteries with this flu.
Why did it stop?
It pretty much, like every other flu, burned through the world. Everybody that could get infected pretty much was infected. And the only way a flu can continue is to find people who are still vulnerable to it. Because once you've had the flu, you develop antibodies that protect you from that particular strain. So a new one would have to come out the next year in order to infect people again.
Where does a virus go when it's run its cycle in the world?
Well, you know, we're not the only people who get infected by flu viruses. A lot of animals get infected too, and it can go into pigs. It can infect lots of different kinds of animals, and so, in fact, that's one reason it's impossible to wipe out influenza. And you might say, let's just immunize the whole world against whatever the strains are out there now, and then we'll get rid of it like we got rid of smallpox. But since we're not the only species that gets flu. It's impossible. You can't immunize all the wild birds and the pigs and the cows and the goats and everything else out there. So flu strains can go into animals. They can mutate. They can change. And pretty much they have to mutate in order to stay as an infectious disease.
Does that mean the 1918 virus is no longer there?
It went away in 1918. Well, to a large part, it may be still alive in some form in pigs or something today, but it probably mutated into something different. But the concern that scientists have is that it's clear that a flu virus can turn into one of the worst killers, one of the worst infectious disease epidemics ever known. Something we never would have thought of with influenza, but this shows it's possible. Almost everybody that was alive then is not alive now. So most of the population has no antibodies, no natural protection against that flu. If you've lived through it, you're protected against it. Most of us haven't lived through that flu. So if the virus is going to mutate into something that would allow it to get a foothold in the population, which it has to do every year, we know it's possible to mutate into something like that. And we know the population is vulnerable to that particular strain of flu. So there's a lot of concern that that virus could come back, or that there could be another way that the virus could mutate into a killer, and that could come back. And I think the concern is there's a constant worldwide surveillance for influenza strains, and scientists are always on the lookout for things that could be deadly, and they had a couple of real scares recently on that. And the fear is that people don't believe scientists. When scientists say we're worried about something, I think that many people don't think they're just crying wolf, and that it's just a lot of hype. And people don't trust flu shots. They think flu shots will give them the flu, or flu shots are useless. So I think the fear that a lot of people, public health people, have is that even if they get some advance warning, and you need 6 months to make enough vaccine for everybody, even if you get some advance warning and you get the vaccine and you say, okay, everybody, get immunized, people will say, I don't believe it. I don't ever get sick. I won't get this flu. And once something like this gets going, it's kind of too late.
Gina Colata is our guest, science reporter for the New York Times and author of a new book on flu, the 1918 epidemic, but the life of these viruses then and ever. I'd like to, I mean, you're talking about the history of 1918, Gina Colata, but your book is also a very, very modern biological detective story about men who have, in effect, dug up the frozen bodies of people who died of the flu in 1918, looking for the structure of that virus. In what sense is this a very contemporary modern scientific search? Why do we feel so related organically to the killer bug of 1918?
Well, actually, flu viruses only have 8 genes, and they have sort of basically the same structure, and it's only minor changes that make it different from year to year. And in fact, the flu virus that's going around now is a so-called H1N1 virus, which just refers to this to the two of the proteins on its surface. So was the 1918 flu an H1N1 virus. So it's not like this is a dramatically different virus that would never be seen, that has no bearing on what we see today. It's just a minor variation. What's really intriguing is you would think, well, here was this horrible flu. It went by in 1918. Historians never talk about it. Families all over the world, like your family, like my family, were dramatically affected by that flu, where children were left orphans, brothers were lost. But you might say, well, how would you ever know what that virus looked like? The people that died of it in 1918 are long dead. The virus was in their lungs don't exist anymore. You'd never know what it looked like. And in general, that's what you would always expect that. But what's just sort of astonishing is just by incredible good luck, scientists, as you've mentioned, have been able to find three little scraps of lung tissue from people who died in 1918 and have pieces of the virus still in it. And molecular biology has advanced to such a state that scientists are able to, just pushing the limits of what's even possible, pick out these small, tiny, tiny molecular fragments of the virus and start piecing them together, like putting together a mosaic, and asking, what did these genes look like? What was it that made that 1918 flu so dangerous?
I wish you'd introduce these flu hunters.
I'd love to. Thank you. One of them is a really amazing guy. His name is Johan Hultin. He's a pathologist who lives in San Francisco now. He's retired. He's about 72. And in 1950, he'd come to this country as a young Swedish medical student. He was supposed to study for a year in Iowa. And he overheard a eminent virologist talk about 1918 and say, you know, the only way we'd ever know what that virus looked like is maybe if we could find somebody buried in the permafrost where the ground never thaws, their body's still preserved, maybe that virus is still in their lungs. In 1951, he went to Alaska by an amazing story. He happened to know where to find people in the permafrost. He went to a tiny, tiny Eskimo village where all but five adults had died of that flu within about a couple of weeks, leaving almost all the children orphaned. They'd been buried in a mass grave. There were 80 bodies there. And he got the Eskimos' permission to dig in that grave. He told them that this flu had been terrible, and he wanted to try to find the virus so people could make a vaccine and they would never be struck by it again. So they gave him permission. He dug down. He started to dig by himself. It was quite an effort, because digging into permafrost is apparently like digging into rubber. You try to put your shovel in and nothing happens. He went down there and he found, first thing he saw was a little girl, perfectly preserved, still in the dress she was buried in with her braids. He discovered there was all the bodies there were preserved. So he took out some lung tissue, brought it back with him to Iowa, and in an experiment that I think would sort of frighten people today if they heard about it, but obviously they will if they read my book. He tried to grow that virus in chicken's eggs, which is the way scientists grow flu viruses. He wanted to get the 1918 virus out again. It turned out that he was unsuccessful. He used up all of his tissue and nothing grew. So he decided the virus was dead. But he never forgot that virus. And he always thought, if science advances enough, he wants to go back there and he wants to get that some more tissue and give it to some scientists who can do something with it. Just by an amazing series of circumstances, science did advance that much. And there was a guy at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. His name is Jeff Taubenberger. He's a molecular pathologist, and he had gotten really good at extracting little fragments of virus from decayed tissues. He'd been asked to look at dolphins that were dying all over the world, and the question was, were they dying because of pollution or because of a virus? So he actually was able to extract the virus from the dolphins and show they were dying of what looked like a measles-type virus. And then he said, I've gotten so good at this, I wonder what else I can do. So he realized that there's a warehouse, this vast warehouse of tissue samples that was started by President Lincoln just after the Civil War. Mm. And every time a military pathologist examines a tissue sample, like if you're looking at a cancerous tumor or some tissue from somebody that died, they're supposed to put a piece of that tissue into this warehouse along with the person's medical records. So Jeff Taubenberger said, I wonder if I could get tissues from people who died of that 1918 flu. So he put in a requisition for people who died very quickly in 1918 of influenza. He didn't want people who lingered because he wanted the virus to still be in their lungs. He got 100 samples back, these little scraps of lung tissue that were soaked in paraffin, soaked in formaldehyde and wrapped in paraffin wax. He looked in them, in two of them so far, he has found pieces of that flu virus. When he published his first paper, saying that he thought he was on the track of this, Johann Hulton saw it, wrote to him and said, you know, I know a place in Alaska where maybe I can get some frozen tissue for you. So he went up there, Johann Hulton went up to Alaska again, no publicity, did not want a media circus, told the Eskimos if he found nothing, they never had to tell anybody in the world that he'd ever even been there. He went up, dug in that same grave, got some more lung tissue, sent it to Jeff Taubenberger, and now Jeff Taubenberger has lung tissue from three people, two soldiers who died on the same day and didn't know each other. One was in South Carolina and one was in New York, and a woman, Eskimo woman, who died in Alaska shortly afterwards. All three of those tissue samples happened to have fragments of that 1918 flu, and he's now been able to get it's a very tedious task, but he's been able to get he's able to get the complete sequence, the complete code for three of the eight genes, and he's working on the rest. And his goal is to try to figure out why was that flu virus so deadly, and how would you recognize it if it came again?
On the chance that it might. We're talking about flu, the World War I history of it, and the millennial contemporary science of it with Gina Colata of the New York Times. I want to go to the phones, Gina, but I want to just ask very, very quickly. In 1918, this is pre-penicillin, before mass immunizations against anything, what did medical science at the time do against the flu, and was it in the least effective?
Well, nobody had ever isolated a flu virus, and so they tried lots of nostrums that were totally useless. They had what they called immunizations, which were just quackery. So there was really nothing they could do. But what's really pretty astonishing is even today, there is a way, obviously, of protecting yourself against bacteria that often can come into your lungs when you're infected with the flu and give you a deadly pneumonia. But there's, when you say, what could you actually do against the flu? There are four drugs on the market, but none of them will protect you from the flu. None of them are like a penicillin for the flu. They'll slightly shorten the time in which you're sick. But that's not the same as having something that will really knock that virus out. And even today, the best way of protecting yourself is with a vaccine.
1-800-423-8255 makes the flu connection with Gina Colata. A story of history, a story of contemporary science. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Jane is calling from Draycott, Massachusetts.
Yes, hello?
Hello, Jane, welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I wrote an essay, actually, about the influenza 1918 back in 1995. About its effect in Lawrence, Massachusetts and Draycott, and looked a lot into the history back then. It was interesting in writing about it in 1995. It was very hard to find information on it. There was one book, Alfred Crosby's America's Forgotten Pandemic, and very little else. And I spent a lot of time with the health records in the city of Lawrence, and it was very interesting. They had an influenza journal where all the doctors recorded their visits to the various people. Lawrence was an immigrant city. there were 45 different languages and dialects spoken at that time. So
these were big mill towns at the time.
Yes.
Making cloth for the whole world. What was the sort of social history of that epidemic, Jane?
Well, it was interesting. As the flu progressed, the doctors, of course, the beginning of the record is very detailed, the name of each victim, age, place, where they live. And as the days wore on, the notations in the journal got more hurried and hurried and hurried as doctors just became overwhelmed by it. And the reason I began writing the essay is my father, who was born in 1910 on our farm here in Draycott, remembered seeing the tent hospital they set up in the city of Lawrence to take care of the flu victims. They, one night, all of a sudden, the Tower Hill in Lawrence was filled with lights from the tent hospital that they had never seen before. And it's interesting, there is one recording in Lawrence of one of the nuns, one of the sisters of the Good Shepherds, who tended the flu victims in Lawrence. And she talks about how they took care of the sick and that people would be admitted into the tent hospital. A lot of immigrants didn't want their children to go because they were not allowed admittance, only the sick were. So they wouldn't see their child again unless he were sick, he were dead or cured. And
this is fascinating. Yeah. Gina Coletta, does it sound familiar?
It does. And especially her explanation of how hard it was to get information. I mean, people were denying it in the beginning. And even when people died, they often wouldn't say flu. There was a memorial service at Fort Meade for people who died of flu. And as each person's name was rung, hung out, that the sergeant would say, "Died on the field of honor, sir." I mean, it was one of these things where first people wouldn't talk about it, then they would use euphemisms, and then you would end up with these situations where undertakers would say, "We're too overwhelmed. The bereaved families have to bury their own dead. The corpses would start to pile up," and pretty soon it had gotten to a point where, as Jane says, it was almost like something out of the Middle Ages.
Mm. Jane, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the flu connection. Terry is on the line.
Yes, thank you. I had a question for Ms. Collara about the book. My mother and I were recently talking about how her father grew up during this time and how that might have affected him, and I wondered if in her book there were any chapters about the psychological effects and the emotional effects that it would have on children of that time.
It's hard to know. All I did was discuss it's hard to know what it would be like because there's so little historical record. I mean, as Jane was saying, there's a lot of this is just each individual family's tragedy, which I try to convey. I mean, when children are left orphaned or when they lose a father this happened in my own family, my husband's mother, she lost her father to the flu, and she had to leave school before she finished eighth grade and start working in the factories to help support the family. And you see these individual tragedies repeated over and over again, and it's got to have a terrible effect. But what happened, if you look at the historical record or even a lot of the news reports, was when the flu burned its way through the world, after it was over, it was like one of those nightmares of World War I. Mm. It was sort of all wrapped up in this horrible period, and then the Roaring Twenties started, and pretty much the flu was not discussed except for among family members or friends. And now when I talk about it, people come forward all over the place and say, "Yeah, this happened in my family." But if you try to look and say, "Okay, so what do we know about psychological effects?" It's like each thing is each private tragedy, but not a big. There's been like no big studies of what happened to the survivors of the flu or the family members.
Okay, thank
Terry?
You. Thank you.
This is fascinating that it had real effects to this day in your own family, Gina.
Well, we didn't even realize it at first. There have been so many euphemisms here. My mother-in-law always used to say that her father died in 1918 because he got pneumonia from working in a foundry. And we never even thought about this as being anything sort of unusual, a young man sort of dropping dead of pneumonia. So I asked a number of the flu specialists, and I said, "Does this make any sense?" And they said he almost certainly died of that 1918 flu. But, you know, until I wrote the book, we never realized it.
Was there a social stigma here? I mean, Jane is talking about mill towns in Massachusetts where every disease, in a certain sense, was a political disease. People worried about anthrax. They thought, I mean, there was all kinds of social inequity, but also social superstition about disease, too. I mean, what was the kind of social burden of having the flu?
Well, since everybody was getting it, one of the problems was that the people in the poor areas of various towns were really kind of left on their own. And there are some real horror stories, like a mother dying with her twins in bed, and she's lying there dead, and the twins are still there. But in some areas I wrote about in the Southwest, some of the middle class women took it upon themselves as sort of a mission to go to minister to the poor. It wasn't like people would say, because of course when you're the more crowded your conditions, more easily the flu is going to spread. But it wasn't as if everybody turned their back on the places that are worst afflicted. In fact, there are many people who went out day after day, doctors, nurses, and women who were just volunteers and said, we want to help here. There also, there were people in various places where they said, we don't want anybody to infect us. And they wanted, in some Eskimo villages, the Eskimos guarded the villages with guns and wouldn't let anybody in. They were the ones who escaped the flu. Hmm. In Samoa, one group of islands said, we don't want any ships to dock. We're staying isolated. And they escaped the flu. And they also escaped that Parkinson's epidemic that followed it, by the way.
Stand by, Gina Coletta. Gina Coletta covers science and medicine for the New York Times. Her new book is about what everybody's talking about, the flu from 1918 to today. Our phone's 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the construction site Blocks and Building Toys for Girls and Boys Aged Infant to Infinity. Toys with connections that snap, stack, screw, and slide together at constructiontoys.com. And by CSC Consulting, helping clients achieve business results through innovative consulting and systems integration solutions. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR. Christopher Lydon, this is the flu connection. We're talking about the flu in history and in the world today. 1-800-423-8255 is the flu connection phone. Gina Coletta of the New York Times is our guest. We're joined also by Dr. Edwin Kilbourn, who's the Dean of Flu Virus Researchers, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at New York Medical College. Dr. Kilbourn, why didn't my flu shot work?
I think your flu shot did work.
You mean I'm still alive?
Yeah. I think the problem with this conception, which seems to be very prevalent right now, that flu shots don't work, you get the shot and you get the flu anyway, is based on several things. In the first place, if you got your shot the day before you were exposed to someone with flu, it's not going to work. It takes about 2 weeks for the shot to produce immunity in most people. So get your shot early if possible.
Yeah, I did.
The other reason is that lots of viruses out there, other than flu, that we know are circulating at the present time. Flu shots only prevent disease caused by influenza viruses, which are very specific agents, as Gina's been telling you.
How much do you know, and how much do you have to know when you design a flu shot about the new strain of influenza that's making people sick?
Well, the first thing we have to learn is whether it's significantly different from the one that's currently circulating. And even now, the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, are searching for viruses in Southeast Asia and in the Southern Hemisphere, which is their wintertime, in the summer, to see if viruses are circulating there which are significantly different from the ones we have now. If that's true, then these may be next year's viruses. In any event, excuse me, I do not have the flu, but I have something else.
Okay.
Because I got my shot. In any event, it's only provident that we take these new strains as they appear, They're sent to our lab and other labs by the CDC, and we've had the capability for recombining them with laboratory strains since 1971 to produce new vaccine strains. Because the virus, as it comes out of people, is not very good for industrial production of vaccine. It has to be made to grow better. So we're in the paradoxical position, opposed to all common sense, of making viruses grow better.
You know, you were part of the Gerald Ford's mass immunization against the swine flu in the mid-1970s. I must say, I remember that mainly because Jimmy Carter spoke about it at the Gridiron Dinner. He said, why is President Ford spending all this money on flu immunizations when he simply could have put Evans and Novak, the political columnists, in quarantine? That was kind of an inside joke at the time. But why didn't that mass program work?
Well, it probably did work. I think it did what it was supposed to do. We were threatened with a virus which seemed to be like 1918, because even before the exhumation of the virus, as Gene has been telling you, there was evidence from antibody studies of older people alive in 1918 that something very like the swine influenza virus, which is present still in the American Middle West, was the cause of the 1918 epidemic. So when swine influenza virus appeared at Fort Dix, and not only appeared, but it proved to be transmissible from person to person, that was of grave concern to any of us that knew something about flu. Because here was a brand new virus appearing that hadn't been seen presumably since 1918 or the early 20s. It was capable of transmission. It was being transmitted within a military post where people are closely in contact, and it seemed inevitable this would go someplace. So I think it was a very good insurance policy. I don't think we kill the insurance companies when we don't have an accident. But the program was roundly and soundly condemned by many, but applauded by others. And I think it's well to remember that even after the head of the CDC was fired as a direct result of the virus not appearing, not because the program failed, but the virus failed to appear, that the new secretary of HEW let the virus or the vaccine be used later that spring when a small epidemic occurred in Florida. And I think it's also well to recall that there's been an increasing production of influenza virus ever since that time and an increasing acceptance of it by the population. So I think the supposition that that program damaged the image of flu vaccination is just plain wrong.
Dr. Kilbourn, you know Gina Collada. Gina Collada, you know Dr. Kilbourn. Gina, pick up the ball here. What is the chance between the kinds of research that you've both done? What's the real risk that a killer virus of 1918 proportions could ever return? Gina?
I don't think anybody can ever say that, because there's no way of knowing. Like, I always think of it as, you think about the flu viruses as like a bell curve of danger, of infectivity, dangerousness, whatever. This is on the very tail end, the right-hand side of the bell curve is how I think of it, 1918. So you know a virus can like that can be out there. But the question is it likely? Well, probably not. We've seen it once. Is it possible? Yes. When is it going to happen again? Who knows, because these mutations are pretty much random events. So people are vulnerable to it. Could I just say one thing to back up what Ed was just saying about the 1976 thing? I think to myself, what would I do if I were in Dr. Kilbourn and others' position in 1976? You know, there's something that looks frighteningly like the 1918 flu. A soldier actually had died from this thing. And you're asked, should we get vaccine ready and vaccinate people to protect them from this, or should we wait and see what happens? I would be really surprised if many people would say, I think we'll wait and see whether we get a real epidemic that's a deadly epidemic. Because when you think you have to take 6 months to prepare and get this vaccine thing going, I mean, it's just sort of hard to believe. In hindsight, you could say, oh, well, you know, the virus didn't appear. But at the time, how it would be very hard to say, well, we'll just take a chance. So I just wanted to sort of reinforce what he was saying. When I read the history of that time and what people had said, I thought if I were in their shoes, there's no way I would have said, let's just wait and see if we have a deadly epidemic.
Interesting.
Thank you, Gina, for your usual exhibition of common sense.
Dr. Kilburn and Gina Coletta.
Can I answer that question?
Sure.
In a somewhat different way?
Specifically the question about whether it could come back.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just jump in with a different one. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think the question is a simplistic one, and the answers that I think tend to be simplistic, because I don't think we should look for the answer in 1918 in the virus itself. When we have a pandemic, there are many situations operative. 1918 occurred right at the termination of World War I. There were population dislocations. There were crowding of people together. It was also a time of bacterial epidemics. And it's well to bear in mind that most of the people that died in 1918 flu died of secondary bacterial pneumonia caused by streptococci, pneumococci, and Haemophilus influenzae. So it's a multifactorial situation. So I think in terms of the future, we might indeed have a virus which was similar to 1918, which I think was more virulent than the viruses we see now. But I think the impact of antibiotics and vaccine and so forth would not really make it likely that we'll ever see 1918 again.
If they get vaccinated.
Stand by. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. This is the flu connection with the Dean of Flu Researchers, Dr. Edward Kilburn, and the medical reporter of the New York Times, Gina Coletta, whose book is called Flu, about 1918, and the research into it still more than ever today. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Chad is on the line.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Chad. Thank you.
Good. I have a minor background in biology, so I understand the basics of this and how the flu is out and it's always there and we're never going to get rid of it completely. But what is it that triggers a flu outbreak? Is it the fact that, for example, we have a winter flu outbreak, we never hear of really a summer flu outbreak? Is it the fact that that change in the weather, that cooler weather, gives the flu an environment to thrive? Or that the people's immunity is down and then that gives the flu a window to get in and then become epidemic? What's the trigger, if you would? What's the one thing that lets the flu get in?
Dr. Kilburn?
I think the answer is all of the above, with the chief factor being indoor crowding. And in the North Temperate Zone, the low relative humidity we have in the average dwelling. Because the virus has been shown to survive longer under conditions in the air, under conditions of low relative humidity. In summertime, the relative humidity is higher. It tends to wash the virus out of the air rapidly. But I think principally it's indoor crowding. In the tropics, for example, it's the rainy seasons that are the flu seasons, although it can occur all year long.
What about lack of snow? We get a mild winter in 2000, and everybody's got the flu.
Well, I don't. People still live indoors. People still ride subways and go in the phone booths. So I think that it's all relative. Actually, chilling itself and the cold has not been shown to be a factor in experimentally induced influenza. So I don't think it's the chilling per se. I think it has much more to do with the crowding situation.
1-800-423-8255 makes the flu connection. Thank you, Chad. 1-800-423-TALK. Walter is calling from Long Lake, New York.
Hi.
Hello, Walter.
My father's mother was a Finnish immigrant living around Saratoga in late 1918. She was very pregnant with my father, who was born in January, 81 years ago. She caught the flu, apparently was very sick, nearly died, but got through it. My father was born, and he went 60-some years before he ever even had a cold. He has, heard recent talk about this 1918 flu, and he's wondered, and so I'm wondering, is there some possibility, that my grandmother's strong immune response was passed on to my father in such a way that he was immune to colds for so many years?
Gina, do you take this guy's question?
Well, he may have inherited from his mother a genetic predisposition to really be able to fight off respiratory illnesses very well, but it's he could have inherited from your, from the father, too. I mean, it's just, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, it's clear that some people get are very vulnerable to respiratory infections and other people aren't. And most and many scientists think a lot of the explanation is in combinations of genes that you inherit that make you more or less able to fight these things off. So, yeah, maybe he got just the right combination of genes. It's kind of remarkable to go all those years and never get ill.
Walter, you have strong lungs of your own?
Not that strong, no.
That combination was lost.
Yeah, but you know, you mentioned this rather particular immunity to similar related or identical flus, and I just, you know, the question would be is it possible that there would be a more general viral immunity passed on?
I know what you're saying. I think it's a really good question. I was going to mention one thing, though, Ed, and that is that there are at least, and I don't think in general of a viral immunity, but there are people who are immune to certain things, like there are people who they think were immune to, say, the Black Plague or something. So there have been situations where you can get, or people who are immune to AIDS cannot get HIV. So there are situations where you can inherit something that makes you immune to something, but I never heard of, and I guess I never heard of either, somebody being genetically immune to all flu viruses.
1-800-423-8255 makes the flu connection. Jillian is on the line.
Yes, hi.
Welcome, Jillian.
Yes, hi, Chris. I love this show.
And thank you.
So many other people do, too. It's wonderful.
We love the listeners.
Oh, good. I wondered if you could, your guest could address the connection between that flu and Parkinson's. I know you had mentioned that there might be a connection.
Well, many people thought there was. I'm not sure they quite still do. There was a time when people thought that Parkinson's would die out forever because the 1918 flu victims would die out eventually. It didn't turn out to be exactly that case. What is the medical connection here, Dr. Kilbourn?
I think the connection is really that when you have the world's population involved in an event, that there's an understandable tendency to blame anything that happens on that striking event of the pandemic. There is, as yet, no direct evidence, even with the capacity to recover the virus genes from brain tissue and so forth, that there are any remnants of flu virus in any of the brains of people. I think it's also unlikely because the flu virus, by its very nature, is not like herpes virus, for example, which can be latent and persist in the body for long periods of time. It does not persist for any period of time at all. It could have damaging effects which would be carried over, but I just know of no sound evidence, and there have been a lot of investigations of this, that would implicate flu and Parkinsonism.
Gina, do you want to add to that?
I asked a lot of people like Ed that exact question, and I generally got that kind of the same answer, which makes a lot of sense. If everybody has the flu and then a whole lot of people get Parkinson's, how can you separate what's cause and effect and what's just coincidence? So you happen to have the flu, then you happen to get Parkinson's. There's only one thing that sort of was interesting, and I don't know what to make of it, and that was the situation I mentioned in Samoa, where the group of islands where they isolated themselves and they pretty much did not have an influenza epidemic at all. In fact, they didn't have the 1918 flu. They didn't have the subsequent Parkinson's epidemic, whereas the other Samoan islands where they did have an influenza epidemic, they did. Now, that could just be sheer chance. I mean, things happen. There are disease clusters by just pure chance, or disease non-clusters.
And that's also small numbers, Gina.
That's right. So it's very hard to make a huge deal out of this. Somebody mentioned to me, another doctor said, well, maybe it was the immune response, the very robust immune response to the 1918 flu somehow caused Parkinson's. But Parkinson's researchers say that they don't know of any evidence that Parkinson's disease is caused by some sort of an immune response. So Parkinson's remains a mystery, and I haven't seen anything anything that I thought was compelling to connect it to that 1918 flu, but that's been a persistent belief. And in fact, Oliver Sacks' book, Awakenings, was about people who had gotten Parkinson's disease in that Parkinson's
yes.
epidemic. And the implication there is, once again, that it had a connection to the flu. But it's, I mean, that is a very tenuous, although very intriguing, connection.
In 1957, we forget, we had a pandemic at that time. And subsequent to that pandemic, the so-called Asian flu, there was some evidence statistically of an association with the congenital abnormality of anencephaly. But again, it doesn't hold up when you look at the total number of cases. And again, you have a situation of sort of an enormous exposure of a whole population to something and then finding undue prevalence somewhere.
It's one of those things that statisticians call multiple endpoints. You don't start out by saying, oh, we have a flu and we think it'll cause Parkinson's disease because of such and such a reason. Look, here it is. It's like there's probably millions of diseases that the world could be subject to. At any given time, there may be just coincidentally an increased incidence of one of those diseases. So if you say, oh, we see this increased incidence, and oh, look back, everybody had the flu, it's very easy to draw a really false connection, because you're almost always going to have an increased incidence of something given all the diseases out there.
Let's get a couple more calls. Gina, 1-800-423-8255 is the phone. Lynn is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Lynn Ranish. We've talked before. Thank you again. This is a topic of great interest to me because I'm starting a family history. And as many people, this was just a story in my family, and it's been fascinating to see that it really has been blocked out of history. It was nothing I ever heard about anywhere else, and I'm glad about the current interest in it. I'm particularly interested in disease and social history. My grandfather was a Bohemian immigrant, came to America, worked very hard, was very patriotic and grateful to be here because he was, you know, almost drafted in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he wanted a country of freedom. But he turned around and then enlisted in the American, war effort in 1918 in World War I. And like many of the enlistees, never made it off the shore. He ended up billeted with thousands and thousands of soldiers. Apparently, there were just hundreds of hospital tents set up on the Washington Mall filled with recruits and soldiers that were dying right and left of the flu. And he said he sat there in his bed and watched all these young, strong men around him dying like flies, quote, and he wasn't going to let it happen to him. So I don't know if his remedy worked or he was just a tough guy, but he insisted that the nurses, and I guess they were obliging because nobody really knew what to do for people, he had them bring him hot water and lemon every hour, and he sweated it out, and he said he was just dripping, and they changed his bedclothes like every couple of hours, and he recovered. And this was a story from my family. And I'm very interested. So he survived, and a lot of guys didn't, and never made it into action. And I'm just interested, too, in the dilemma that the military faced. There was a PBS program, and they said here they were, you know, needing to ship all these soldiers on ships to the war effort, but in putting them on the ship, most of them might be sick by the time they got there or dead. So I'm just curious about the World War I. Any comments on my grandfather?
I want to know what Dr. Kilborn and Gina Collada think of the lemon toddy remedy, which a lot of people swear by.
I'll let Ed take that one.
I think that and good luck will take you a long way.
Good luck, strong genes, the right parents,
right.
Bohemian
yeah.
immigrant stock or something.
Right. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. We haven't talked about all the other things that people think work or hope might work. What chicken soup for starters, bed rest, reading, echinacea, 3 weeks before you're going to get it, kinds of stuff. Dr. Kilborn, for all the folks who didn't call but who are getting it, worried about getting it, what do you tell your friends?
Get a flu shot. It's not too late.
I did, and look at me now. Gina Collada, what do you tell folk?
Get a flu shot. It's not too late. So I was laughing. I've been saying that to people for weeks now.
So have I.
I think reading the book might be a good idea, too. The book that we've been learning from all over the place is Gina Collada's book on flu, the story of the great influenza pandemic of 1918, and more particularly, the search for the virus that caused it. It's still going on today. Thank you, Dr. Edwin Kilbourne, and thank you, Gina Collada, the New York Times science and medicine correspondent, and the author, in this case, of flu. Thank you, Gina.
Thank you.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations, magic-hour.com. And by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com. PRI, Public Radio International. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.